Jewish audio on Kabod.org.
This class is presented by Rabbi Nissen David Dubov, director of Chabad, South London, England.
Julius Caesar was perhaps one of the greatest figures in English literature. So Julius Caesar is perhaps one of the greatest works in English literature, and we're all enamored by the plot of Brutus against him and so on and so forth. But little do we realize, in fact, that little plot in the book, which is read by all students of English literature, played such a significant part in Jewish life. This evening, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to move from one of the most mad figures in Jewish history, Herod, until the destruction of the Second Temple. And it's a very important period indeed, because it is the period in which the infighting, which we referred to last week, came to its fore, and it culminates in the destruction of the Second Temple on the 9th of Av, which was the turning point in Jewish history, because from then on, Jewish nationhood in its own land ceased to exist. The Jewish nation continued, of course, dispersed throughout the world. Let us start this evening with Herod. If I may remind you, Julius Caesar had opted to support Hyrcanus and his advisor, an Idumean Antipater, for power over his opponent. Now, Antipater had a son. This son was called Herod, a ruthless and sadistic man. Antipater appointed his son as the governor of the Galil, of the north. And Herod, immediately upon attaining power, took a position where he felt totally in control. He was not answerable to any greater court, and whenever he smelled any sense of rebellion, he crushed it mercilessly. His actions so angered the people that, in fact, he was ordered to come and appear before the Sanhedrin, which still was the supreme court of the land, the 71 sages in Jerusalem. He was summoned because he had committed murder. However, he didn't arrive in humility, he arrived in style. He came to the Sanhedrin dressed in royal robes, armed guards accompanying him, in full contempt of court. The judges at the time were all afraid of him. We know that one of the great principles of Jewish law is that however strong or powerful the litigant seems to be, the judge must not at all take any notice, and he must judge truthfully. The judges, however, were afraid, and it was in fact only one of the judges, who was called Shammai, who in fact stood up and said, "No, we must judge this man truthfully," and in fact they condemned him to death. Hyrcanus, who was the Jewish king at the time, was afraid of this condemnation because his greatest advisor, who was Herod's father Antipater, would have been terribly slighted at the death of his son. So Hyrcanus asked that the trial be recessed for a day, in which Herod made a quick flight from Jerusalem, and thus his life was saved. Herod fled to Damascus in Syria. Somehow or other, by great intrigue, he got himself appointed as the Roman military governor of Lebanon, and raised an army of mercenaries to come and destroy Jerusalem, because they had wanted to kill him. As he came towards Jerusalem, his father, who was much more of a diplomat, persuaded his son not to take such an offensive stand and to cool off. Now, how does the Julius Caesar plot go? We know that Brutus and Cassius plot against Caesar and they kill him. Julius Caesar was murdered, and Antipater, the advisor to Hyrcanus in the Holy Land, now was left with a difficult political stand, because until this point he had supported Caesar in all his efforts. He quickly changed sides, however, and expressed his loyalty to Caesar's murderers, to Brutus and Cassius. Soon after that, Antipater himself was poisoned and died. Thereafter, there were changes also in the Roman hierarchy. Cassius and Brutus, as we all know, were themselves defeated by the supporters of Julius Caesar, Octavian and Antony, in the famous Battle of Philippi. That was the name of the battle in which Octavian and Antony defeated Brutus and Cassius. And the hopes grew in the Holy Land that since Antipater had sided with Brutus, and now Antony had come into power in Rome, perhaps Antony would depose the Idumean governor and allow the Jews again to re-establish Torah rule and supremacy in the land. However, again, the charm of Herod, the personal persuasive powers of Herod, persuaded Antony to pardon his father Antipater, and Antony, in fact, appointed Herod as a ruler. And although Hyrcanus, as we said beforehand, was officially still in power, it was in fact in name only. The true power in Israel then became Herod. Now, we find how deceptive and intriguing Herod was in the following story. It all goes together with the love stories of Antony and Cleopatra. You see, because Antony, who was, how shall we say, bewitched, perhaps, by Cleopatra, was held inactive in Egypt for a certain time. And at this particular juncture, one of the last of the sons of Aristobulus, if I just can remind you, Aristobulus was Hyrcanus's rival. Aristobulus had a son called Antigonus, and he saw the inactive state of Antony as an opportunity to go and attack Hyrcanus. Antigonus made a pact with the arch enemy of the Romans, who at that time were the Parthians. They were in control of what earlier was the Babylonian Empire, Persian Empire, and so on and so forth. And Antigonus marched on Jerusalem with an army. He, in fact, managed to get into Jerusalem and took his rival Hyrcanus, who was the high priest, and inflicted a wound on his ear. That's called in Hebrew a mum. A high priest who had an open wound was not allowed to serve as the high priest in the temple. Herod himself fled the land because of this onslaught, and in fact only one fortress remained in the hands of the Idumeans and the supporters of Herod, and that was Masada. It was to the fortress of Masada that Herod sent his fiancée. She was a woman called Miriam, or Mariam. In fact, Mariam is a kinui, a derivative of Miriam, who was the daughter of Hyrcanus. He sent her there for safety. Now, it's interesting. Hyrcanus was the son of Antipater, who was an Idumean. He, however, sought to kosher himself by marrying a Jewish girl, by marrying the daughter of Hyrcanus. Of course, the people hated Herod, and they proclaimed Antigonus, the new invader, as the high priest and as king. Herod was not to be beaten. He went to Rome, and by that time Antony had gotten back to Rome, and he personally requested Antony to support him. Antony appointed Herod as the king of Judea, and sent him with a huge army to attack Antigonus. Herod besieged Jerusalem for 5 months, and a great slaughter ensued. He in fact managed to conquer Jerusalem. Upon entering the holy city, Herod slaughtered a huge number of the Pharisees of the Torah, true Jews, and all but destroyed Jerusalem, except upon his explicit command, the temple itself. His first act in true power, once he had taken Jerusalem, was, as any mad ruler does, to eliminate all your opposition. And in the case of Herod, it was an absolute paranoia. He was so paranoid about threats to his person and to his position that he literally eliminated all the closest people to him. First of all, he had his rival Antigonus killed. He killed all the members of the Sanhedrin except Shammai. It's an interesting point over here. All those earlier who had dilly-dallied and who were afraid of him, he killed. And the one man who had stood up and said the truth, he let live, because he admired him. He married this Miriam, the daughter of Hyrcanus, thereby trying to kosher himself by marrying a Jewish girl. And he thereafter hounded all other descendants of the Hasmonean dynasty until he, in fact, killed the Hasmo dynasty dead. So that dynasty, which has started off with Yehuda Maccabee, the great Yehuda Maccabee, or in fact even his father Mattathiah, who had started that rebellion in Modin 200 years prior to the destruction of the Second Temple, now, having reigned with different kings over a succession of 100 years, was finally dead. Every last male member was killed by Herod. In Rome, power was changing hands. Herod this time switched from supporting Antony to supporting his opponent Octavian. They themselves had been, had fought together against Brutus and Cassius, but then a power struggle erupted between Antony and Octavian, and Herod went for Octavian. And in fact, this Octavian, he changed his name, or perhaps his name was changed, to the Emperor Augustus. And it was Herod who sided with Augustus. As I mentioned beforehand, Herod was so paranoid, he even had his own wife and mother-in-law executed. Because of various intrigues, which we really don't have here the time to go into, we could perhaps say about Herod that it was upon the execution of his wife that he descended into a most tragic melancholy and depression. And he tried to fight that depression by building. And he went thereafter and built the most magnificent towns and mausoleums and cities. In fact, he built the city of Caesarea, which there became the capital of power, even above and over Jerusalem, which in fact the ancient foundations and excavations of Caesarea even exist today. And as perhaps an act to befriend the people, although the people hated Herod, in the 18th year of his reign, 90 years before the destruction of the Second Temple, Herod began an 8-year reconstruction of the Second Temple. Now, if we think about it again, let's just cast our minds back. Approximately 300 years earlier, the Second Temple had been built by Zerubbabel with the commission of Cyrus of Koresh, and it had over the 300 years been invaded and had its walls gone up and gone down numerous times. However, it was in the period of Herod that the temple was refurbished and rebuilt to the extent that the rabbis in fact attest to in the Talmud, that somebody who never saw the building of Hordas never saw beauty in his lifetime. It was a magnificent reconstruction. He in fact employed priests, Kohanim, to give him Torah direction as to what would be ritually acceptable, non-acceptable, the building materials, the dimensions, and so on and so forth. The only thing he did do, which was really annoyed the people, is that he placed a golden Roman eagle on the entrance to the temple, which angered the people very, very much. I pointed out in my lectures on prophecy and providence that it is fascinating that in the admonitions to the Jewish people which Moses gave us in the wilderness, he does say there that a nation will swoop down on us like an eagle, and particularly the bird eagle is mentioned. And it is fascinating that the eagle was the bird which was the bird on the Roman legion bearers. It was the Nazi symbol as well. And yeah, the Nazi symbol, well, and in fact this was the symbol which Hurdus, by the way, is Herod's Hebrew name, which Herod placed on the temple, which angered them no end. He finally executed his own children, Herod, paranoid that they would take over. Bloodshed continued until his very last day, 5 days before Herod died. A rumor spread that he had died. Thousands of people rushed to the temple to tear down the golden eagle, to celebrate. But Herod was not dead. He ordered all those that had rushed to the temple to be killed, and he killed so many people that it was impossible for anybody to rejoice when eventually he did die, because of the great mourning that the people were in, because of the great slaughter that he did just before he died. He did reign for a total of 37 years. The entire time full of intrigue and plotting and bloodshed and ruling without any conscience whatsoever. The people called him, or perhaps historians called him, Herod the Great, because he did enlarge in the land and he did build magnificent palaces, which, as I said, the relics of we have today. But he was cruel, he was sadistic, and he was mad. I'm sure many of you have been to Masada. Masada itself was also refurbished, in fact, by Herod himself. It became one of Herod's palaces. And one can look out over the beautiful Dead Sea from Masada and realize why this man invested perhaps so much effort to create such a beautiful palace. Now, although I did say beforehand he did execute his sons, he executed those sons who had Hasmonean blood. He did have different sons from different wives, and his oldest son was called Archelaus. And this oldest son became king once Herod had died. However, it didn't take too long for the people to find out that he was a replica, unfortunately, of his father. On the first Pesach, after Archelaus became king, the people rebelled. The people couldn't take it anymore. And in fact, Archelaus had 3,000 of the Jews who rebelled against him in the temple massacred. And he, Archelaus, left for Rome in order to get his official recognition from the Emperor Augustus. Now, when he was away, there was a tremendous uprising in the land. The people really had had enough of Herod, and they were desperate to have some normality brought back. It wasn't to be. The uprising was mercilessly crushed by the Romans. 2,000 Jews were crucified, and in fact crucifixion became the mode of killing, the accepted mode of killing. And Augustus gave Archelaus a bit of a slap on the hand and told him, listen, be more kind to the Jews in the land if you want to be their king. He didn't take their advice. And what he did was that he manipulated them. He decided that the best way to deal with the Jews is to get most money out of them. And the way you get the most money out of them is you manipulate them for power. Now, the position of authority was the position of the high priest. And Archelaus said, whoever wants to be the high priest can bid for it. And whoever pays the most gets the position. He thus had a succession of high priests who were unscrupulous and paid for their position and no longer had the recognition from the people that they once had had. He offended the religious terribly. Finally, Augustus himself, the emperor from Rome, saw that this man Archelaus was not a good ruler, and he himself deposed him, and instead put into position neither a king nor a high priest. But what he put into position was a succession of people who were called procurators, who were in fact military governors. However, they, as Archelaus did, saw that although there was, since there was such tremendous civil strife in Israel, different factions, they could best serve their own purposes by taking a back seat and just imposing super taxes on the people and having a wonderful life in Caesarea and suppressing any rebellion that even dared to challenge their position. Rabbis tell us a very interesting thing. A high priest who entered into the Holy of Holies on the day of Yom Kippur and was not worthy of it would die. He would not live out that year. And in fact we find that year after year the high priest died because they were not worthy of the position. And yet many still came forward to offer the highest bid to get that seat of power. So we can perhaps see an insight from here how corrupt even the highest position had become. I'm going to introduce a move away from the temple, but it's a move away which I'll come back to a little bit later, and just say it in one sentence now. Perhaps the spiritual focus of the people now moved away from the Beit HaMikdash to the Beit HaMidrash. Now that's a very significant move. It's a move from the temple to the house of study. Perhaps at this time the source of inspiration no longer came from the temple and its corrupt leadership, but it came from the houses of study and the rabbis who led them. And we will come back to them later. One of the procurators, I didn't feel this evening that we should go through all of them in great detail. Let it just be said that none of them had happy spells in office. All of them were cruel and sadistic. All of them brutally crushed any opposition. However, there was one of them of great historical significance, and he was a man who I'm sure you've all heard of, called Pontius Pilate. Very disrespectful. He in fact put a statue of the new Roman emperor, who was called Tiberius, after Augustus came Tiberius, he put a statue of the new Roman emperor in the temple. Only when he saw that all the Jewish people gathered in the temple and they told him, they flatly refused to bow down to the idol, and he saw he'd either have to massacre all the Jews in Israel or take the idol down, he figured to himself he might as well remove the idol, because this way he's not going to get the taxes. And that's what he did. He removed it, and he then levied the people with a higher tax. The people, in fact, eventually, the Jews sent a delegation to the emperor Tiberius, who had Pontius Pilate removed. It was, however, in the time of Pontius Pilate that we need to discuss the rise of Christianity, because it was at that time that Yeshu, we'll refer to him as Yeshu, that's his Hebrew name. What? JC? Not to be mixed up with the Jewish Chronicle. The Yeshu Hanotzri rose. Now, let's get it right. In English, they translate it as Jesus the Nazarite. And you think usually of a Nazir in the Bible, meaning a person who is not allowed to drink wine and cut their hair. In fact, he's in fact called Yeshu Hanotzri because he came from Nazareth, came from Nazareth. Now there's a whole discussion. I'm not going to go into this evening the origins of Christianity and of course the whole debate as to when in fact he even lived, where he was born, if he was born, where he was conceived or immaculately conceived, and so on and so forth. Because there are great debates amongst the scholars, not within the realm of this evening's discussion. We're going to touch on a few points. Why did he have a rise to power at that particular, or why did he have a claim at that particular moment? We could make the following points. Herod had crushed the Hasmoneans. And interestingly enough, one of the reasons why we could suggest even that the Hasmoneans were unsuccessful were because they were not of Davidic descent, and they had risen to a position of power which really was not rightfully theirs. The spiritual situation in the land was devastating. The people were looking forward to somebody who would reinstate the Torah, would reinstate the temple, and in fact, again, usher in a calmer, more utopian period than what they were living in. So they, in fact, they were looking and readily awaiting a Messiah. In fact, the word Christ means anointed, which is what the word Mashiach means. In fact, the word Mashiach, in its first usage in the Bible, is referring to one who was anointed with oil. For example, Saul is referred to as the Mashiach Hashem, the anointed one of God. David is afraid to kill Saul because he was the anointed one of God. King David is referred to as the anointed one of God. And this refers to the early practice of anointing kings with oil as a process, as the procedure where they were elevated into their position. So, the people were waiting. He came and he said that he in fact was of Davidic descent, and he was the Messiah. Now, there is a great discussion as to, in fact, how he died. Was it the Jews who condemned him to death, or was it Pontius Pilate, who condemned him to death. One thing is for sure, I'm not going to go into that discussion, one thing is for sure though, if we want to just look at the political situation at the time, what we can definitely state is that any Jewish uprising at the time would definitely have been crushed by Pontius Pilate, because he wasn't in any state to look for that sort of thing. If we were to compare it, for example, with what happened at the beginning of the rise of the Hasmoneans, what did we have then? You had the Greeks in charge, and you had Yehuda Maccabee, who arose, and what did he do with a few against the many? He destroyed the Greeks. Well, the Romans didn't want any of this. In fact, it's even fascinating, it crept into Jewish literature even years later. Years later, here we have the Talmud, or the Mishnah, the earlier work of the Mishnah, which was the forerunner for the Talmud. Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Judah the Prince, who lived after the destruction of the Second Temple, still in Roman times, there is a tractate in the Talmud called Tractate Megillah, which discusses the Purim story, but there is no tractate called Tractate Chanukah. In fact, there is only one very obscure reference to Chanukah in the entire Mishnah. It is not talked about in the Mishnah. And this has puzzled scholars. Why is it that Judah the Prince, who, when he wrote down for the very first time the oral tradition, never wrote down the story of Chanukah? And they give two reasons. Number one, because Judah the Prince felt that although the beginnings of the Hasmonean uprisings were noble, and in fact God dealt the Jewish people and gave them an amazing miracle, the miracle of Chanukah, however, since it ended in the successive kings proclaiming themselves as king, which was not intended for their dynasty because the king was to come from Davidic descent, he therefore dismissed them. And although Chanukah is celebrated as a miracle, it was not, if you want, quoted in the Mishnah. Another reason, which is perhaps more plausible than that reason, is one of political sensitivity. Quite simply, Judah the Prince did not want to write down in the oral tradition the fact that the Jews had successfully rebelled against the Greeks and had driven them out of the land, because that may serve, which is is the greatest written work of the Jews at the time, that may have served as fodder for the Jewish masses to be incited in a rebellion against the Romans and to do the same thing. And of course, that was after the destruction of the Second Temple, which we'll soon see was an amazing destruction. There is in the Talmud, which was much later. Talmud, of course, was written in Babylon, which wasn't under Roman control. In the menorah, you have a discussion, because the menorah was in the temple. Don't forget, the Talmud cites a controversy between the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai as to how one should light the Chanukiah. Should one light it beginning with 8 candles in a descending order? That's how the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel. Now, Hillel and Shammai, we will soon learn, lived in the period just before the destruction of the Second Temple. The house of Hillel and the house of Shammai were students of Hillel and Shammai that lived for almost a century after them. So there was tremendous discussion between, and the Talmud cites that. So in other words, there's a tremendous discussion of the Chanukah celebration even while the Second Temple was still going. But what I'm bringing out is that in the Mishnah, which is the first recorded repository of oral tradition upon which the Talmud is based, there's very little mention of the whole Chanukah story. Not really, because immediately the year after the Chanukah story, all the sages agreed that they should light Chanukah candles. So, for example, right throughout the Hasmonean period, and apparently right until, you know, from then on, everybody lit Chanukah candles. So the Chanukah story tradition and ritual was very much then already engraved in the people. There should be no reason why it should not have been, if you want, canonized within the Mishnah, yet it wasn't. And this puzzled all the great scholars, but I think the most plausible reason is because of this political sensitivity. Why did I bring it in here? I brought it in here because whatever you say about what happened in his lifetime, the fact that he ended up on the cross, A, was no different than thousands of other Jews who met the same fate at this time, and B, if he had wanted to in any way create an upstart, in any way to oust or to challenge the Romans, that is the fate that they suffered at the time. Now, how did it develop? Really, it was students who developed Christianity. His brother, Peter, and of course Paul of Tarsus, all of whom were Jews. James and Peter saw themselves as fully fledged Jews, and in fact kept all the laws and traditions of Israel. To them, Yeshu brought an added dimension. They saw him as the Messiah. If you believe in the story of the resurrection, then he was resurrected, and if you believe, as they do, that is the body of the divine, then he's resurrected and brought back in order to usher in the messianic era, which of course did not happen. The truth is, as I said, I'm not going to go into as to when it came up, but if you want the ideology behind it, is because here you have the resurrection, the story that developed is that here you have God embodied in the human being who is to bring this redemption to society, and remained as a small group or a small group of people who believed, and if one could, if you want, excuse them almost at the time as being a plausible Jewish belief, and that here you had a group of Jews who were, for all intents and purposes, Orthodox Jews who were desperate to find, that the Messiah should come, and had a figure in whom they believed was that person. I don't think they at all had in mind, or certainly the earlier students didn't have in mind, that this religion was to be taken out of its context, as Paul in fact did it. Because when he saw that it was not going down with the Jews had in the main rejected it for a very simple reason. The Jews believed in a Messiah who would deliver. For example, Maimonides in his Laws of the Messiah, which is based on the Talmud, and that's oral tradition which the Jews had then. The Jews had the belief that the Messiah is a person who would rebuild the temple, or this, of course, talking after the destruction, in those days they had the temple, but he would reinstate, if you want, the temple. He would, if you want, reinstate the state of Israel as it was then, that it would become an independent state, unshackled from any oppression or interference from the outside, and that would be ushered in a period of kingdom on earth, God's kingdom on earth, which meant that from Zion would go forth the knowledge of God. That did not happen. So the Jews, when they saw that this was not happening, rejected it. Paul, when he saw that it was rejected by most Jews, decided to do the following. In order to continue those teachings, he had to find a new audience. The new audience which he could find was a much larger and more receptive audience, which was the pagan audience. Now, once you move over to the pagan audience, you really need to renounce the belief of the Jew. The Jew will therefore become an object of hatred. You have to state that those things which we did till now have now been abrogated. That although Moses came and gave the law, that was to a certain point, but now it's been abrogated. And this is questionable, even when this is questionable, whether Yeshu himself even, or certainly his immediate followers, in fact wanted to achieve. There's a great dispute about this himself. And of course they read into his meaning, and they did abrogate the laws of Moses. Having said that, since all their ethic and all the ethic and moral code of Christianity is Judeo-based, they couldn't, if you want, throw the entire pack out of the window. Had to retain some of the ritual. Therefore, what they did, in fact, was a lot of. There are great similarities in early Christianity to a sect which we discussed some time ago, 2 weeks ago, I think, called the Essenes. They were called Tovle Shacharis in the Talmud, the people who used to immerse themselves every morning. And the whole idea of baptism, really, is the idea that when a person becomes a convert, they immerse in a mikveh. And unfortunately, in their case, they are becoming converted, if you want, into Christianity. That's the idea of baptism. Circumcision was abrogated. Why? Because circumcision was for the Jew and not for the Gentile. Dietary laws, Sabbath observance, could not altogether be uprooted because it was so engraved. So, you change the day. And so it moved from Shabbos to Sunday. Well, it was so engraved with the creed, if you want. You see, the problem with the pagans is that you move a pagan to belief in God, then you've got to move him to a ethic and moral code as well. Right? Otherwise he can believe what he wants to believe in. Now, moving him over, I think that the great splits in Christianity were caused because they could not define correctly which moral, ethical, and most important theological idea to move the pagans over to. Was it that of Trinity, which is an extremely difficult concept to understand, that of Catholicism, that of the Protestant Church, and therefore we have a myriad of splits in the Church itself, and so on and so forth. And as there was a leader in the Times this week, which said quite amazingly, that it is phenomenal that although there is a lack of clarity within the Christian Church in expressing its most fundamental beliefs, not that each one doesn't articulate what they believe in, but there is such a difference between them, and yet it's all originated from one man, and yet it was also successful, that it is quite a phenomenon that all this was caused by, in his time and in the time that he lived, in the way in which he died, quite a common Jew. When I say common, I don't mean to say that he wasn't dynamic, but he was common in the sense that he was quite similar, one of many, or quite similar to the people amongst whom he lived. And of course, this whole question of whom he was born by, his father and his mother, and where he actually came to, whether he was supposed to be born in Bethlehem, although he's called Yeshu HaNotzri of Nazareth, when did he move there? This is a question of discussion amongst the scholars. I'd like to just add and close the discussion on Christianity with one comment of Maimonides, which is a fascinating comment. In fact, the Kuzari also makes this comment, which is a very, very fascinating insight into Christianity. Surprisingly, there are very few references to Yeshu in Jewish writings. If you look through the Talmud or major Jewish writings, he's often referred to just as Osei Ha'ish, that man, not even referred to him by his name. In fact, the people who read into things say that Yeshu, Yud Shin Vav, is three letters, a Yud Shin and a Vav, which stand for the lower words Yimach Shemoi V'Zichro. May his name be blotted out, and his memory be blotted out. And his name is very rarely mentioned. Now, this may not be so surprising in the light of the fact that all Jewish books were censored when they were printed. So when printing came into effect, all the printers were censored by Christian authorities. It's not surprising that they therefore took out any reference to Yeshu, because they didn't want to. Either the printers took them out because they didn't want to offend the censor, or the censor took them out because they actually read something which was they didn't want to be there. Recently, I'm talking in this century, a handwritten manuscript of Maimonides was found in Yemen, which then was an Arab country, not a Christian country, and not censored by Christian authorities. And in this handwritten manuscript, it was found that right at the end of Maimonides' book called Mishneh Torah, he makes a comment about Yeshu. And he says, and identifies, that Yeshu was the man about whom Daniel the prophet was talking to him. It's talking about him. And then Maimonides asked the question, the famous question, and how come he has had such a powerful influence? Says Maimonides, the ways of God are mysterious. However, one thing we can definitely see is that his followers have, excuse the expression, spread the gospel to the furthest and most remote corners of the world, including, says Maimonides, the Iye Hayom, the islands of the sea. The furthest islands. In fact, we once read an article that the evangelists, in fact, made a special ship, an evangelist ship, which they specifically sailed to the most furthest and remotest islands to spread the gospel. And one of the most fundamental teachings of that gospel? Their belief in a Messiah. That one day a Redeemer will, in their case, return to the earth in order to redeem it again. So perhaps one could summarize and say the most redeeming factor of Christianity is that it teaches and spreads the idea of redemption, so that the whole world is in fact full of talk about redemption. Now, I think, and it is, everything is by divine providence, it is by extreme divine providence that we happen to be giving this talk, particularly this week, as we're standing just before this weekend. Not in my program for this week. But again, everything is by divine providence, because we have today in the media focused two worlds looking at redemption. You have today the entire Christian world focused, I would suppose, primarily on what's going to happen in the next millennium, and of course the media press is full of people of the millennium and so on and so forth. But the religious, or perhaps the theological connotations of this millennium, in many an evangelist and in many Christian eyes, particularly in the extreme groups, are talking about the coming or the second coming of redemption. That coincides with the belief of many Jews that the Messianic era is near, for reasons which they give, because that's based on Talmudic descriptions of the pre-Messianic era. And therefore, again, in history, Messianic fervor is at a very high pitch. And the differences are clearly coming out. On the one hand, we have today where a Jew can win the preacher of the year. Think about it, a Jew, not talking about just but in a Christian country, a Jew, a rabbi, should win a contest of a preacher of the year. We have that scenario where now Jews and Christians are on an equal, if you want, keel. And Christianity is looking introspectively, whereas we all know, highly featured in the media this week, was the question whether to create a saint out of the Pope who was at the time of the Holocaust. And revelations are now coming out that he was perhaps one of Hitler's greatest accomplices in the murder of the millennium. And now they're looking introspectively and perhaps seeing their own faults, seeing where their own theology has allowed them to become so base. I'm not saying Jews are faultless either, but I'm saying people are now looking at it objectively. And what is happening is that both worlds, or everybody, is looking forward to some form of redemption. Now, following on from all the revolutions which have taken place in the last 150 years, the technological, the industrial revolution, the technological revolution, the computer revolution, the IT revolution, the world needs one more revolution to complete a revolution. And that is a spiritual revolution, in the sense that today the world has all the resource necessary to feed mankind. It has all the resource necessary to educate mankind. It has all the resource necessary to create world peace and harmony. The only one thing which is lacking, I would say, is the will to do so. The will to do so. And I think that has to be the job of the Mashiach. The Mashiach has miraculously, I would say, that is the job, to create the will, or create or spiritualize the world, to focus it on its own ability to be able to create world harmony and peace. I was having a discussion with somebody this week, and he said that human history has pointed against that. What makes you think that that can be achieved? And I pointed out to him that leadership of great magnitude did in fact allow people to change. Abraham did, with great leadership, bring a pagan world into belief in monotheism. Moses did lead a people out of the desert, and we believe in a figurehead, a Mashiach, who in fact will allow the world to be at peace with itself. And I think that the Hasidic perspective in all this is that this has to come hand in hand with a deflation of the egocentricity of society. This is what we must internally preach as Jews, that we must become less focused on the I and more focused on the you, more on the soul rather than on the soil, as we mentioned before. And this has to be the focus of our activity, thereby allowing ourselves to fulfill the full potential which the world does have. I've said this as and in fact, why do I say this? Because this is what the sages said about the destruction of the Second Temple. The Second Temple was destroyed because of baseless hatred, and will be rebuilt through baseless love. How do you achieve baseless love? In my book, I write extensively about this. It's about the ability not to look at the corporeality or the material dimension of the other person, but to look at the soul dimension and to see each other as complementary souls. To see each aspect of humanity not as an adversary, but as a complement. So that when we look at each other, they don't become a challenge to us, but they become something which complements society. And all of us are needed. All of us have an intrinsic worth, value, and contribution to make. Now, I agree, in today's society, I agree it would take a miracle to precipitate that, but that is the miracle, or the miracle of Mashiach, that we are all waiting for. Even the Christian world. So, I think that quote from Maimonides is perhaps the kindest quote that we can leave the whole subject, and come back to the final destruction of Jerusalem. Now, the emperor who succeeded Tiberius was another Meshuggah called Caligula. And unfortunately, we had a series of I use the word mad, but I think it's possibly the best way which we could have madmen who came into power. Caligula was obsessed by himself. He was obsessed by, in fact, him being divine. He ordered that his statue be placed in the temple. The people refused. Now, the people sent a very special man, Herod's grandson, a man called Agrippa, to petition Caligula. And Caligula was impressed by Agrippa, and he appointed him, in fact, king over the Jewish people. After Caligula died, Claudius became the Roman emperor, and he also found in Agrippa an excellent ally. And Agrippa was perhaps the one who gave the people, the Jewish people at that time, the greatest respite they ever had, because he, in fact, was tremendously respectful of the Torah. He, in fact, brought sacrifices to the temple, and he ruled for 7 years, in which Torah law and Sanhedrin reigned supreme, and the Jews had a very brief respite. Suddenly, however, he died at the age of 54. The power, or seat of power, returned again to series of procurators, as we said beforehand, and a certain pattern emerged. And the pattern was that the Roman procurators would incite the Jews to rebel, only to crush them afterwards. This was the pattern which evolved. And the greater the rebellion, the greater the crushing. And in fact, what the Romans really wanted was a really big uprising, and then they could finish them once and for all. Now, these rebels were called the Zealots. After the Emperor Claudius died, another sugar came on the scene, but we all know about him. He was called Nero. In fact, his Hebrew name is Neroin Caesar. And it was Nero who appointed the last of the procurators, a man called Jesius Florus. And this Jesius, he incited the Jews absolutely no end. And the Jews could not take him anymore. And finally, the open rebellion came, and the Zealots, there was a huge uprising. And they, in fact, as in the Greek times, managed to crush the Roman legions. And Nero, of course, felt this was the opportunity that he had been waiting for to finish them off once and for all. Nero dispatched a very successful general called Vespasian. Vespasian was aided by his son, a young but brilliant general called Titus, to crush this rebellion. And Vespasian came with 60,000 of Rome's best troops to the area. They thought that the war would be won swiftly. That was not to be the case. There are many stories of the great and, if you want, superhuman in certain cases, fight, a very valiant fight that the Zealots put up against the Romans. The war dragged on for 3 years, and this was against Romans' best. It literally drained the Romans. There's a whole story in this particular point in history about a man who is an important historian, Josephus Flavius. I wrote a book called Josephus. The Jews saw him as a bit of a defector, in fact, because he originally was appointed by the Jews to become a governor of the north, of the Galil. He headed the rebellion in the north against the Romans. He was the captain, if you want, of one of the greatest strongholds. And when the Romans attacked, he really valiantly held out. It was only at the last minute, when they had scaled the walls and were to crush this rebellion at a place called Yot Fata, did Josephus manage to stay alive, and in fact defected to the Romans, the Romans accepted his defection, and in fact he became an ally and of course witnessed and came to witness the destruction of the temple and recorded it, and therefore we have the book Josephus as one of the accurate historical accounts of what happened at the time. Other fortresses around up and down the country resisted stubbornly. Finally, however, Galilee was taken, and the Romans marched on Jerusalem. Civil strife ensued when the Romans marched on Jerusalem, because as always there were two opinions amongst the Jews what to do. Some of the Jews said, look, we're not going to beat the Romans. They've come this time with too big an army. And the Zealots, however, they were going to fight to the end. Now, at this point in history, happened a most important story. This is recorded in the Talmud in Tractate Gittin, where the Talmud devotes five pages to discussing this particular story, the story of the destruction of the Second Temple. But it starts with the following maaseh. The rabbinic head of the Jews at the time was a man called Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And it was his nephew, who was a man called Abba Sikra, who was one of the heads of the Zealots. Jerusalem, in fact, at the time was a well-stocked city. It could have lasted out stubbornly against the Roman onslaught. It was well fortified. In fact, the Talmud says there were three rich men in Jerusalem. One called Nakdiman ben Gurion, the other one called ben Kalba Sabua, the other one called ben Sitsis Akesis. It's an interesting story about these three men. Nakdiman ben Gurion was a very wealthy man, whom apparently the sun had once come out for him again. There's a whole story. Ben Kalba Sabua means literally the son of a satiated dog. He had a restaurant that anybody could go in as hungry as a dog and come out smacking his lips as a dog does when he's had his fill. The other one was called Ben Sitsis Akesis, a man who was so wealthy he had a red carpet in front of him wherever he went, so his long tzitzis never trailed on the ground but always on a carpet. These people had enough money to keep Jerusalem going with firewood, oil, flour, food, for over 20 years. And yet the Zealots did a treacherous act of burning down all their storehouses. And the reason they did that is because they wanted to force a famine which would force the people inside to fight. And it forced them out of a negotiating permission. In other words, the Zealots didn't want any compromise. This was a win or die situation as far as they were concerned. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai saw that he must escape Jerusalem in order to preserve the chain, golden chain of tradition. He saw that he must take students away from Jerusalem and he must preserve the house of study. There's a famous story how he did this. He feigned death. He pretended to have been dead. Was carried out of the city by two of his students, and in fact the Zealots wanted to knife him, literally. They wanted to stick a spear in his body as he was being carried out, and one of the students said she wanted to be said by the Romans that they even knifed the head, the rabbi. So they let him out. And this Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai got out of the camp and presented himself before Vespasian, who was, as we said before, the general who was dispatched to come and destroy the city. The story goes that in an exchange between Vespasian and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Vespasian was very impressed by the rabbi because of certain answers which he gave him, and he asked Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai what he wanted. And Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai made a small request. A small request in terms that he felt he couldn't ask for a peace treaty because the Romans had already spent huge resources in coming to destroy Jerusalem and they were going to finish the task. But it was a request which Vespasian did not twig. He did not realize that this request would keep alive Judaism until today. He asked for Yavna v'chachomeha. He asked, give me the little city of Yavna and its wise men. Let me retire gracefully over there. You do what you want with Jerusalem. And Vespasian agreed. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was of course from Davidic descent, went to Yavna, took his students there, and thereafter Vespasian continued the assault. It wasn't in fact Vespasian who continued. In that meeting between Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and Vespasian, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai told Vespasian that he in fact was going to become the emperor of Rome, because it says only an emperor would destroy the temple. And Vespasian in fact at that very meeting was recalled to Rome because he was to become the new emperor, and it was Titus in fact who led the assault against the temple. There is the defenders resisted absolutely stubbornly. Many thousands of Romans died. Many attempts to breach the wall failed. Titus, in fact, constructed a wall around Jerusalem, not allowing anybody out, so that a famine and starvation ensued. Finally, it was on the 17th of Tammuz, which is even today a national fast day, that the wall was breached. Many Jews tried to escape. In fact, once the wall had been breached, it wasn't just an inlet for the attacking legions, it was also an outlet for the Jews who wanted to escape. 5,000 of them poured out of the walls. They were desperate to get out. They didn't want to be holed up there by the zealots. Titus crucified them all in one day. In fact, it said on that particular day there wasn't any wood left anywhere to make more crosses than they could possibly do. I won't go here into the step-by-step destruction of Jerusalem. It was a very bloody affair, in the sense that each stage, each wall, each parapet, each entry into the temple precinct was saturated with Jewish blood, and many hundreds of thousands of people died. And yet, it was on the 9th, finally on the 9th of Av, in the year 3828, 420 years exactly after the beginning of, after the building of the Second Temple, that the Second Temple was destroyed. And most significantly, on exactly the same date, the 9th of Av, as the First Temple had been destroyed. Only the Kotel, the Western Wall, which in fact was of Herod contributed, surprisingly enough, to a million Jews died in the defense of Jerusalem and the destruction of the Second Temple. 100,000 were sold as slaves. Many more were sent off to fight in Roman amphitheaters and circuses, being thrown to the lions. And the zealots continued to resist, as we know, the last bastion, perhaps, of resistance being Masada, and they chose suicide rather than submitting themselves to the Romans. In fact, those who have been to Masada, what I found fascinating at Masada when I went up there were a number of things. It was very moving when I went there. I was fascinated by the square walls of the Roman legions outside at the base of Masada, the fact that they constructed these square areas to encamp in. I was fascinated by the ramp, which was built by Jews, and of course the Romans employed the old ploy of getting Jew baiting one against the other. And I was fascinated by the amazing water systems up there, the complexity and the fantastic architecture. Of magnificence of Herod's palace and so on and so forth. And most moving was standing in the synagogue looking over the sea, watching the sunrise, and of course praying there.